Colonel Drummond, Drill 4. After you'd had this guest night and had the piping, what usually did the participants do then?
Well, after that, we'd probably go down and possibly dance an etsome reel or a foursome reel, or two etsome reels and a foursome reel accompanied by the pipe major. And the guests would watch, or perhaps they'd even join in if they knew it or wanted to. And then after that, then some people would probably play bridge, other people would settle down and talk over drinks. And as we had a billiard table, other people would go and either play some wild game like billiard fives or possibly even play billiards. And then when the last guest left, it was a regimental guest night, then we'd all go home to bed.
You were not allowed to leave before the guests?
No, we were supposed to stay on before the guests. I think it would have been rather rude to have left after they were regimental guests. And if you had an ordinary guest night with your own guest, well, of course, you could leave after your own guest had left.
What time would that be usually about?
No idea. I suppose the mess was about 8 o'clock. I suppose it would be sometime between sort of 11:30 and 12.
Could you take me through a typical day to show what the daily routine would typically be like for the officer in India?
Well, you would be called by your bearer, who would go and get tea from the mess, early morning tea, and bring it across to you. And then you would get up. Some people were shaved by the Indian barber while they were asleep, but I never was. The Indian barber would come in and shave people while they were asleep. And
what time would this be?
I suppose about 6:30 in the morning. And then you would go off on early morning parade, which would either be PT or drill. And perhaps on a Saturday it might be an entrance parade. Then you'll probably come back, I suppose, about 7:45, and go into the mess and have breakfast. And then after breakfast, you'll then go off to your company, your platoon commander, or company commander, he would take orderly room. That's to say, anybody who happened to be up on a charge for being idle on parade or something like that would appear in front of him, and he would hear the evidence and all the rest of it and decide what punishment to give the chap. And then if he did give him a punishment, he would probably, as a subaltern, might have to enter the thing up in his company conduct sheet. Everybody had a conduct sheet. And if it is a serious case, then he might remand him to go to the commanding officer. And after all the room, you would go out and do various parades according to what the training programme was. That is to say, you might have a period of drill, you might have a period of weapon training, you might have a period of PT. And this would go on till about 1:15, I suppose, and 1:15 you'd go back to the mess for lunch, and the troops would go back to their place and have their ordinary dinner. And then as it was very hot in the afternoon, most people used to have a siesta in the afternoon. And then you would probably in the course of your company, you would probably arrange for various platoons or whatever it was to play a game of hockey or soccer against some other platoon, so that you did get your people to do some football. And you might go and watch it yourself, or you might not, or you might play your own games after you'd had a sleep. So you'd have a sleep in your bungalow, and then your bearer would come along with a cup of tea at about 4 or 4:30 and wake you up. And then depending on what you were going to do, if you were a person who played polo, you'd go down, change into your polo kit and get bicycle down to the polo ground and play your chuckers of polo. If you didn't play polo, you might go to the club and play tennis, and have a drink afterwards at the club. Or if you didn't do that, you might, if you were good at games, play at hockey or football, you might play football with your platoon or company. And then at the end of that, you'll probably all go down to the Gymkhana Club, this is an officer, and possibly drink, and then you'd come back and change into your mess kit and go off and have your dinner in the mess. And then at the end of the mess, you'd either sit and chat about it, or people might want to play bridge or something like that. And then you wander off and go back to bed sometime between, say, 10 and 11. And one got very used to changing. I mean, you used to have one of these tin baths, and with the aid of your bearer helping you to dress, one used to be able to have a bath and change to the mess kit in about 5 minutes.
How much maintenance did all these kits that you described earlier on require in India?
Oh, I don't think very much, no. I mean, your bearer used to clean it. No, they lasted you out for a long time. Then it was quite cheap to get the stuff replaced, because our master tailor in India was a very good copier, and so he could copy anything that had been made, and of course it was about 1/4 of the price you'd get it in England. So that, as I say, you only bought one drill tunic out and one draw mess jacket out, and then your master tailor would copy the rest.
You didn't get any special problems with deterioration of leather or anything like that because of the climate?
No.
What about the weekly pattern? Can you tell me about that? Which days you worked and which days you had off?
Well, I worked on Mondays, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, and then Thursday, as far as I can remember, was a holiday for the anniversary of the mutiny, I think it was, or the end of the mutiny. Thursday was a holiday, and Saturday was a half day, and then Sunday, of course, was a holiday. So that you really had quite a lot of holidays.
And what about the yearly pattern? How did that vary according to the seasons of work?
Well, what happened was that when the hot weather came on, if you were in Lahore, one of the or Jhansi, one of these stations where it was very hot, I suppose about April or May when it started to be hot, half the battalion then moved up, or let's say two companies perhaps and half battalion headquarters moved up into the hill station, where they sat for two or three or two months or whatever it was, and then they would come back to the plains, and then the other half of the battalion would go up to the hills. Because if you sat down in the plains the whole time, it really sort of got you down, because it was very hot. I mean, in Jhansi, in very hot weather, the temperature by day was about 110 to 113 or 14, and it never went below 96 at night. And so when you were sort of sleeping out and got to bed in a sort of muck sweat, it was a strain, and I think one was apt to get very depressed in the hot weather, and I think we got quite a lot of people committing suicide, or not in my regiment, but you did get a certain amount of people who did sort of suffer from this melancholia and become rather sort of dangerously suicidal. So that it was essential to get people away into these hill stations.
So you didn't have any actual cases of suicide?
No, not in my regiment, no. But there were one or two cases which did happen in Jhansi of other regiments. Not the Indian regiment, I think the gunners had one or two.
Did you have any cases in your unit of people being psychological cases because of...
No. No, I think one was, as I say, one was fairly good at man management, and I suppose if this had happened, one would have done something about it and got the chap sent off, you know, somewhere where he could be cured or something. Because I think the old army, I don't know what it's like now, but I mean, I think the army between the wars was particularly good at man management, and I mean, it was your duty as a platoon commander to find out what was happening in your platoon. And one really felt oneself was really we were responsible to the soldier's parents really for his well-being, and I think it is very essential for discipline, because if a chap had a grievance, which people did have, that you should find out what it was and clear it up before the chap did something stupid like clocking an NCO or getting drunk in order to draw attention to himself, and this was one of the things that you had to do, so that you did look after everybody, you got to know everybody in order to know what their family were, and you chatted to them, and you tried to run the thing as far as you could, as a sort of happy family party, and that they would trust you and tell you their troubles, and you would play ball with them, simple as that. And I think we were good at man management.
Did the troops actually come to you and tell you of their problems? And
well, sometimes they did, yes, or else they would tell it to some section commander or somebody who'd tell it to the platoon sergeant who'd tell it to you. If he couldn't sort it out, and then you'd try and sort it out, and if you couldn't do it, then you'd have to go to the company commander and say, okay, can you do something about this and tell me what to do?
What type of problems did they bring to you?
Well, I can't remember offhand, but I have to sort of think about it. But I mean, they might have a grievance on something, rather, that they'd been recruited under false pretenses or something, or that they ought to have this or that or something or other.
Oh, I see. A problem, not family problems.
No, not particularly family problems.
And then coming back to the yearly pattern, was the pattern of work just interrupted by the arrival of the hot weather and the monsoon, or were there any other changes in the yearly pattern?
No, you did your training and manoeuvres, of course, after the hot weather in the winter, because it was much cooler then. But otherwise, I don't think there was any difference, no.
As a Scottish regiment, did you have any particular ceremonies for New Year's Eve?
Well, we did, yes. We always kept it as a sort of family party. I think that the other battalion did something quite different to us. But what we used to do was that the officers used to have a meal, probably a special meal with haggis in the officers' mess. And when they'd finished that, then the regimental wives would come in. And just for about 11:45 or 11:30 to 11:45, we'd all go off to the sergeant's mess where we would see the new year in. And then they would pass one of these quakes round, full of whiskey, and you'd have to drink the thing and kiss the bottom of the stand, the bottom, to make certain you'd drunk it all. And then they would have a dance going on, and then you would pick up your platoon sergeant or your signal sergeant or whatever it was, I suppose about 1 o'clock, and then you'd go round with him and go and wish your platoon or signal section a happy new year and have a chat with them and a drink with them. And then you'd go to bed feeling very much the worse for wear. And unfortunately in India, the next day, New Year's Day, they had a proclamation parade, which was a big brigade parade, which was the march past in column of companies. And this was a terrible thing to happen, because, I mean, we were all more or less incapable of being able to do anything after this, seeing Hogmanay. And so I think we got about 35% of people off. And I must add, we used to go past in a very ragged line. And I think people were pretty bleary-eyed, because it is on record that some company commander inspecting his company, and indeed the platoon commander, quite forgot to notice that some chap hadn't put a kilt on and managed to get away with it. And then after that, we used to give your platoon lunch. We used to wait on your platoon, having produced sort of as good a lunch as we could with chicken and stuff for them, and free beer, and then we used to go and wait on them and see that they had their lunch, and then they'd probably go and sort of sleep it off. And then you'd go back to the mess and have your lunch and then probably then go back and have a well-earned sleep, go and sleep off the results of Hogmanay.
You were talking earlier on about how bad meat used to be condemned, if necessary.
Yes.
Can you tell me if a great deal more attention was paid to health and sanitation in India to what was the case in Britain?
No, I can't, because I really hardly soldiered in Britain. I think the same, but I think you had to do probably more in India, because I mean, you had an awful lot of flies around the cookhouse and things. You had to get rid of them, and you had to make certain in the company cookhouses and things that they were kept sort of scrupulously clean. The only place that's absolutely filthy dirty, if you ever inspected it, was the officers' mess kitchen, where we had an Indian cook, and it really was pretty dirty, I must admit. But still, we all survived. Nobody seemed to get into trouble.
Did you fall sick in India?
No, I didn't. I was lucky. I did, coming back from Kashmir, have a sort of, not dysentery, but sort of rather bad tummy trouble from swimming in the lake, the Dal Lake, opposite where the Maharaja of Kashmir's drains came out, and I think that may have caused it. But except for that, no, I kept very well.
Interesting that you should have only had that one bout of sickness whilst you were on leave, whilst you were, in other words, outside the supervision of army supervision of health and sanitation. Do you think that was significant?
Well, no, I think the answer to trouble really is that I apt when I swim to drink rather a lot of water when I swim, I think, because the chap with me had no trouble at all and he did exactly the same swimming. So I think it was just unlucky that one did this. I suppose it could have happened to anybody.
So you never got malaria?
No, I didn't, no.
Did the other officers get malaria?
Yeah, some people did, yes. One chap got jaundice, I think, once. Yes, malaria was quite common, but I seem to have avoided it. I seem to have avoided it in Nigeria when I was there too, so I must have a sort of, perhaps a slight immunity to it. Oh, a lot of people did get it, yes. I mean, you're bitten by the female anopheles, and if the female anopheles has happened to bite somebody who's got malaria before and injects it into you, well, then there it is. It's a sort of rather matter of luck.
You weren't...
But it was swept under a mosquito net.
You weren't taking any form of prophylaxis?
No, we didn't. They tried it for a little bit, but then they gave it up. They did try this quinine.
Whilst you were in India?
Yes, tried an experiment for about 2 months, and then they gave it up. I think the trouble was, we used to take it in Nigeria. But I think the trouble is that if you do take it and you do get a go of malaria, they've got to pump so much quinine into you because you've been taking this stuff that I really don't think it does you any good.
What type of treatment did you get when you had the dysentery? Did they give you drugs?
No, because I didn't report it. I treated myself. The result of which, as I said, took me 2 months to cure, and I was so weak I couldn't serve the ball over a tennis net, but it's given me a good tummy ever since.
So you didn't really have any first-hand experience of the standard of medical treatment which the army was providing?
No, it was very good, actually, the army treatment.
Can we talk a bit more about the type of off-duty activities and recreations which you had in India? You've told me a little bit about the sports that you played and the clubs that you had and the type of things that you did when you went into the local towns. Can you tell me about the occasions when you got out into the countryside? Did you go shooting yourself?
Yes, I did, yes.
What type of things did you go after?
Well, John, I didn't really do much shooting in Lahore, because I don't think there was very good shooting. But Jhansi was a wonderful place, because you had these jheels, that's to say lakes, where the duck used to lie. And so if you went out, say, with 3 or 4 guns, you'd post yourself round the jheel, and you probably couldn't put guns round the whole jheel, so you'd have your Indian shikaris and people honking, that's beating with a stick. And then when you were in position, somebody would fire a shot. And then the duck would get off and fly round the jheel and then try to come in and land again. And as they came in, if they were near you, you would have a shot at them. And then they'd go off again. And this would go on, I suppose, about half an hour or an hour. And eventually they'd decide that life really wasn't worth living on this jheel, and they'd go off to another one. And so then you'd collect yourselves and possibly walk round the sides of the jheel for snipe, because there's usually quite a lot of snipe round, and so you'd go around the jheel getting snipe, and then you'd move on either by foot or by car if you could, and go to the next jheel and shoot that. And so that was really what your shooting consisted of. Or you could go out, and I think if you were up in the country in the hills, you could go after things called chikor, which things rather like partridges. But most of our shooting was in Jhansi, which was extremely good shooting. Of course, I was a very bad shot, but we did have some extremely good shots in the regiment.
So did any of the officers go after a bigger game than...
Yes, they did. If they went up to Kashmir or up into the hills beyond Raniket, they would go after bigger game, yes. And my father, when he was out there, went up to Kashmir and shot Gural and Tar, which are sort of mountain goats and things like that. And people used to go up to Kashmir and shoot snow leopards. And then you would go after Bara Singh, which is a big stag, or a cheetle, which is another stag. Those people used to go and do quite a lot of shooting. You go after, I suppose people went after other big game, tigers and things, or set up in a machan over a kill, waiting for a leopard to come or tiger to come.
Did you have to have permission to shoot?
Yes, you had to have a license. If you went to Kashmir, you had a license which was quite cheap, which allowed you to shoot black bear. And if you wanted to shoot snow leopard or anything like that, it was a very much more expensive license. But you were only allowed to shoot so much on your license. And then you went out with a shikari from Kashmir who knew the country and took you about. We went out, as I said, we went up then. We only got... some reason or other, we should have had 2 months, but we only got 7 weeks leave, and we didn't really have enough time to go, because it was the wrong time of year. I think it was June and July, and most of the good animals were much too far away in the sort of snow hills for us to be able to get there, so we contented ourselves with shooting black bear. But we had a very good shikari called Qazir Sheikh, who was very good to us.
What was your entitlement to leave?
Well, in India, every year, you were entitled to 2 months' leave, and every 2.5 or 3 years, as an officer, you were entitled to, if you paid your own passage, you were entitled to 8 months' leave at home. And then you came out, which I think really was ridiculously long, because one really got rather bored towards the end of it. But the wretched, unfortunate private soldiers, of course, didn't get any home leave, and this was really one of the tragedies, because one used to say to these chaps, why don't you take on, they had an engagement, say, of 9 years with the colours and 3 with the reserve. Say, why don't you take on for another 3 years, take on for 12 years and get a good pension? And they would say, no, we've been out in this country for 7 or 8 years without home leave. We're jolly well going back. Then you'll say, well, it's no good, this was in the 30s, it's no good going back in sort of 30, 31, 32, because it won't get any employment, because unemployment is terrible. And they said, well, we couldn't care less about employment. We haven't been home, we haven't seen our families for 8 years, and we're jolly well going home. And so I think that it was very unfair. I think they should have been given leave, say, every 4 years or something. And they certainly couldn't have afforded to pay for it themselves. And so I think that was bad. And then, of course, there was a clause by which if they were due to go home, they could be kept on for an extra year. So that I think they were rather badly treated as far as leave went.
How did you spend your own leave in India, apart from going to Kashmir?
Well, I think I only had one leave in India, which was to Kashmir, because I really couldn't afford to have another leave. And so that the answer is that I only went to Kashmir once, and I think that's the only time I went on leave, except for whatever short sort of going out for sort of weekend shikari or something like that.
Can you remember what your pay was in India?
No, I can't. But when I came home on leave in 31, my pay was about £4 a week. And so I suppose my Indian pay would have probably been about £5 or £6 a week.
What about promotion? Did you feel that promotion came too slow or not?
Well, promotion had varied. I mean, you came out as a second lieutenant, and you had to do 3 years before you became a lieutenant, and that was automatic after 3 years. And then after that, provided you passed your promotion exam from subaltern to captain, it was merely a matter of waiting for a vacancy in your regiment. There were so many captains allowed in the regiment. And if people didn't get seconded, or people didn't die or get promoted, so you had to sit and wait. And some people in the Queen's Regiment, for example, had a very bad block of promotion, and some people had to wait about 14, 15 or 16 years as a subaltern before they became a captain. Other regiments, they could get it after about 11 years or so. So that I think there was a good deal of discontent about that particular thing. I think it was fairly reasonable in my own regiment, but I think it is very unfair why some chap who's just as good as anybody else as a soldier should have to wait on that particular principle. Well, now, of course, before the war, it was done on time. I think we did 8 years as a subaltern, 3 years as a second lieutenant, and then 8 years or 5 years or whatever it was as a subaltern, and then you automatically became a captain, provided you passed all exams, and then you did so much as a captain and then became a major, which was much fairer.
Were these promotion exams more or less a formality?
No, they weren't. There was an unfortunate chap in my regiment who couldn't pass his promotion exams, and eventually it was fixed, I think, actually, that he should pass, and that they told all the people that number so-and-so was to put your number, not your name, on. Number so-and-so was to be put through, and they got the wrong number, and he failed again. I suppose they weren't difficult, but, I mean, they were quite adequate, I think.
Were all the papers solely to do with soldiering, or was it general education as well?
No, I think mainly to do with. I think we had a military history question or an imperial geography paper, and possibly a military history, that's military. And then you had a military law paper, and then you would have tactics and strategy papers, and an organisation and administration paper. I think that's probably about the lot.
Was it solely private study, or did you have a tutor or something?
Well, it was really private study, but you could go to a crammer. And, I mean, crammers are very good. I mean, they would guarantee that here are 4 questions which we guarantee will be asked 3 in the exam. And so you swatted that up if you went to a crammer. But I think you should be able to pass it without doing that.
Who were these crammers?
Well, there are various firms who set up as crammers. I can't remember their names. There was some chap who was a colonel when I was in an OTC camp, whose name I forget, who came round and was very keen and asked about things, and he eventually ran a crammer's. And then there was a crammer somewhere up in the Cromwell Road, whose name I forget now, who did this. And I think they used to work out all the questions that hadn't been asked, and on the balance of probabilities, they would ask these particular questions that hadn't been asked for some time. But I think it's very dangerous to go to a crammer, because especially for a thing like the Staff College, because you merely get a superficial knowledge, who have no background knowledge, and when you really go to the staff college, you haven't got the background knowledge, and you're pretty certain to fail. So that I don't really recommend a crammer unless you have got background knowledge.
Can we go back to what you were talking about earlier on, about the relations between the officers and the men? Did you ever have any court-martials whilst you were there in India?
Oh, yes, plenty of them, yes.
What did you feel about them? Did you feel that they were conducted fairly?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think a court-martial is probably the fairest form of trial there is, because you've got an impartial. I think most of the officers of the court-martial are probably on the side of the defence and sort of slightly biased towards the chap who's being tried and possibly slightly against the prosecution. I think it's a very fair system. I mean, and I think there's not too much what I call law and that sort of stuff in it. So I thought it was a very good type of trial.
What type of cases came up whilst you were in India?
Oh, well, people being drunk, people possibly striking an NCO, and that sort of thing, I suppose, and those sort of things. I mean, before you had a court-martial, the chap was tried by the commanding officer who decided it was a serious case, and then he would remand the chap for a summary of evidence. And so a summary of evidence would be taken in front of the chap who would be allowed to ask any questions he liked, and then the CO would consider the whole of the evidence and decide whether or not it was a case fit to go for court-martial or not. And then he would put it up for court-martial, and then presumably it would go to somebody at brigade or somebody on the entrant general side who'd again look at the papers and decide whether or not the case should come up for court-martial or not. So that I think it was... I think there were quite a lot of safeguards for the chap, and as I say, the court probably gave him a very fair trial.